This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman, and this is the Kenai Conversation. But not really the Kenai Conversation. We're hijacking the conversation today for KDLL Adventure Talks. We've got an Adventure Talks presentation Thursday night, January 16th, at 6:30 p.m. at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center on backcountry skiing the southern Kenai Peninsula with Craig Bernard and Tony Doyle. And we just so happen to have Craig and Tony in the studio. So today I'm hoping to sort of just introduce you guys to our listeners and to folks who are coming tomorrow, and then maybe talk about some of the less photo-worthy elements of getting out and doing a ski trip, like gear and safety and logistics and all that kind of stuff. So Tony, I know a lot of folks around here are familiar with you, but for people who aren't, how did you find yourself in Alaska and how did you come to find skiing?
I grew up in Phoenix, and so that was a strike against me. I do love Arizona, so you Arizona folks, don't worry. My parents, between my junior and senior year in high school, sent me to the Northwest Outward Bound School in the Glacier Peak Wilderness area in the Cascade Mountains of northern Washington. And there I was introduced to the Rainforest Glacier. It was just amazing to see that blue ice and the fir trees, the green trees, and I was fortunate to meet a kid from Kenai on that course, and I told him when I got out of high school, I'm hitchhiking to Alaska to come see you, and, you know, when I got out of high school, sure enough, I hit the road, and further north I got, into British Columbia, up into the Yukon, seeing the huge mountains there in Kluane, and then across Tok, and then down to the Chugach, and seeing the big peaks before I got to Anchorage. And fortunately, the kid was down on the Kenai, so I just kept on going and just saw all these amazing mountains. And this was July, and this was 77, and must have been a good snow year because there was plenty of snow even in July at Turnagain Pass. And I said, boy, oh boy, I want to go out and get some skis. And that's, so that's kind of where I got my start, was just skinny skis back in 77, and been doing it ever since.
I would love to do a survey someday. Maybe the census people can add this to their questions of how many folks have ended up in Alaska because they met a guy, A, they just met a guy, and then B, hitchhiking was involved. I think there's a pretty large proportion of our population that have found themselves here. Yep. Kind of similar themes for Craig. Craig, where'd you come from and how did you end up where you are?
So I started skiing when I was like 2 and...
Two as in like actual age 2.
Pretty much born with skis on my feet. In a small town in Vermont, we had a ski area right next door to our house. So it was a small ski area. We were able to ski downhill to the ski area and back home for soup and then back to the ski area. So had one of those very lucky lifestyles. I'd get off school and work with a ski patrol. Then I started coming to Alaska my summers in college, and I saw the mountains here and I was just blown away. So eventually hitchhiked up here and was able to start having interactions with these mountains.
How was that transition from you coming from more, I mean, Vermont, sort of a more established, I think, probably ski culture, ski area with, you know, lifts and classes and training and ski patrol and all of that, and moving to more kind of backcountry situation?
Luckily, I was able to ski a lot of backcountry growing up. My mom wouldn't let me go out to the social things that a lot of kids would do. And so my outlet was going behind the house and skiing. And if a lot of times the lifts weren't running, so we would cross country ski and ski in the woods, glade ski. My parents did let me do that.
Oh, nice.
So eventually the rule was come home before dinner and have the wood box filled. And so it was amazing the freedom my parents gave me. And that became my outlet and more of what I was living for. And so, traveling to Alaska, and then I would go back and be a ski instructor at another rootsy ski area called Mad River Glen in Vermont. And then I would train for the Alaskan mountains and come up here and ski in the summer. And the mountains in Alaska, it's so easy to want to ski up there. You don't need a lift because they're just calling you. And you're like, oh my God, I've been looking at that mountain since the last time. And usually you're a little nervous about what you're going to ski. And so you're up there just about dropping in before you even want to be, you know, and you're like, oh, we're here already. Okay, it's game on.
Yeah, gravity is an unavoidable force sometimes when you're up there.
Well, what was cool about Craig's upbringing that has really made him an all-around skier is that a lot of skiing on a lot of ice back there in New England. At least that was my one experience skiing in New England. A lot of blue ice at the ski areas, a lot of moisture, that sort of thing. Not a lot of soft snow like out here in the West. But I've been on some glaciers with Craig where he's literally skiing the blue ice, and I'm cramponing down. But and you'll see some of that tomorrow night at our talk and our show. So very versatile guy.
Yeah, you hear about that, people who have skied elsewhere in the country or come from other places that are, I mean, our mountains, certainly the topography and the pitches and the, you know, what shaded and what gets sun and when and what time of year and how late you can ski in the year is a little different. But like the snow quality is different here too than you find in other parts of the country, which kind of blows my mind. You think snow is snow, but no, different.
Yep, that 40 different names the Eskimos have.
That is true.
Yep, the natives have.
I'm sure skiers have their own, probably not safe to say on the air terminology for some types of snow, but I would imagine you guys have your own lingo as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So when you both got up here and you're seeing these mountains and you can't wait to get out and ski them, did you find people to go with or did you tackle it on your own or how did you kind of get acquainted to the backcountry on the Kenai?
You know, for me, I was living in Clam Gulch the first winter I was here and... you know, went out and got a pair of skinny skis. So I would just go out right behind, I guess one time I tried to, I'm going to ski out to the Caribou Hills. I had no idea that it was like 10 miles away. So I take off in dead of winter, you know, right behind the house I was staying at and just following seismic trail or just making my own trail. And I went for about 4 or 5 hours and said, well, that's about far enough. And camped out that night. And the next day, I'm glad it didn't snow that night and just followed my tracks back. I didn't like, oh, I'm going to keep going. No, that's far enough. So that was my first foray into backcountry skiing was just with skinny skis right out the backyard, kind of like Craig. But I was 19 at the time, not two. I wish I would have started skiing at two, but it's all good. But from there, after my first winter in Alaska, I went to the National Outdoor Leadership School and in Lander, Wyoming, and did a mountaineering course there, 30-day mountaineering course, and met an instructor, Willie Saul, whose sister lived in Fairbanks. So that winter of 79, I think it was, he moved up to Alaska right after our course, and he became a good friend of mine. And he was 5 years older than myself and was already a downhill backcountry skier. And so that the first time I really went mountain skiing here in Alaska was, I think, like 1980 on Mount Manitoba there at Summit Lake. Mm-hmm. And we didn't even know there was a mining road that takes you right up there. You know, we crossed Canyon Creek and.
Well, that's unfortunate. That was much harder than it needed to be.
Yeah. But again, this was 1980, 40 years ago. And we did have metal edges on our skis. And beyond that, single leather boots. And so it was fun. It was challenging with, you know, to go up there and still challenging, you know, but so that's kind of my first start in backcountry skiing.
Okay. Craig, how did you come to know the mountains around here? Did you find a group to go with, or you just kind of set off on your own and figure it out?
I think from that background of, childhood, I very comfortable skiing by myself. And so I took on these mountains as kind of a lone wolf. I always feel like you can concentrate more. It's not, definitely not as fun as when you are with all your buddies rallying. And so you're almost training for those rally days when you're skiing by yourself. And I guess that was the best blessing of meeting Tony and my other ski friends is when we all get together, I think I'm just so excited but to be with skiers, you know, I can't even stop talking.
Well, then you don't really need the avalanche beacons as much. Like, just listen for Craig. We'll figure out where he ended up.
Yep.
What all have you guys skied around? I mean, I don't need the whole list. That would probably take the whole hour. But, I mean, I know you guys have done in the Kenai's and I think across the inlet for both of you, too. But Craig, at least, I think you've been over doing some of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Where all have you guys gotten out and played?
Well, I have had the good fortune to climb Mount Redoubt and Iliamna, but really not with skis, which would have been fun. Craig, on the other hand, tell him that story.
I've heard a little bit. Sorry to set you up here, Craig, but I was hoping you would tell us this one.
So we did a trip once for like 3 weeks, and we flew over to Iliamna and landed there, and it cost us, we could have flown anywhere in the world for the amount of money to land a plane there and then get picked up with Mako. So that was our first time going there with Doug Malone and Kyle Lintz. And that was a great trip because we just were just vacationing there and skied all over the place, and we could wait for in the whiteouts. But then a couple years later, I had some buddies that came on, let's say, a Thursday night and said, let's go. The boat's leaving. You're coming with us. And so we went over in a Zodiac across the inlet, and they shook me down before that trip. And I'm like, do I need crampons? They're like, no. Do I need a rope? No. Do we need a harness? No. And so I'm like, do I need food? They're like, no, we got 25 Big Macs or quarter pounders. And so, and we get over to the boat and it's like this deflated Zodiac, and I'm going, oh, whoa.
You were crossing Cook Inlet on. Let's just let that sink in for a minute.
So we cross over there and go skied it in a weekend. And
yeah,
then
that,
came
go
back.
Skied what?
That was Iliamna, and then the next year we did Redoubt, and the same style. Of course, that was a more impressive mountain, and we're getting our Zodiac stuck in the mud flats over there, and sirens are going off from the deep from the terminal over there because it was terrorist warning. And
those are some low rent terrorists showing up in a Zodiac with Big Macs for fuel.
And so we basically wade up a river all day long and go, and we thought the Seracs were stopping us up there. So we follow the Serac right around, and there was like this little passage through it, and we're able to get on top and then ski off. And I got to say, when you're there and you have your skis, it is the right tool to have. When you're at the top and then you're like, all right, now we get to have even more fun and ski off this thing. We had Tyler Johnson's father was flying around. They were trying to throw off some Wendy's Big Macs or some Wendy's burgers at us, but they never saw us. They just saw our tracks coming off the top. We tried to get Mount Spur a little later. And we got whited out, and the conditions weren't right for that. But I've also skied off Augustine and another just grassroots trip where my buddy takes us over in a landing craft. And we just had, like, that is like one of the most amazing summits because there was so much steam coming off. And I couldn't even remember, is this smelling the sulfur? Is this bad for me? And we're trying to figure out the tippy top of the peak and all these yellow. I brought one of those yellow sulfur rocks home for a little souvenir. So people were finding glass balls on that trip. And it was just, that was just an amazing summit.
Yeah, that one blew in, it's been a little over 10 years ago now, I think. So was that before the last eruption or after? That must have been before the last eruption, mm-hmm. I would guess.
That's probably, 15 years ago, 16 years ago now?
So I know that Redoubt blew right after we skied it. Mm-hmm. What was pretty funny was there's a guy that we call Postal Pete. I think it's Pete Sprague.
Yeah,
and he saw us fueling, getting our I think we went to Taco Bell on that trip, And he saw us, and he'd been trying that mountain, let's just say 8 times or something. And he turns to his friend, he goes, "Those guys are never going to make it." And his friend turns to him and goes, "You know, sometimes those are the type that make it."
Yeah.
That is Craig Bernard in the studio with Tony Doyle. This is KDLL Adventure Talks on the Kenai Conversation. These guys are going to be doing a presentation for us Thursday night, January 16th at 6:30 p.m. at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. Come on out and see some pictures and hear some stories about their skiing exploits down across Ketchmack Bay. So how did you guys meet each other?
Well, that was a auspicious meeting between my good friend Doug Baxter, was hiking on Slaughter Gulch Trail, and a beautiful spring, early summer day, and he's halfway up Slaughter Gulch Trail, and all of a sudden he hears like some banging and clanging coming up behind him, and he turns around, and lo and behold, it's Craig with his full regalia on, you know, his canteen hanging off of one side and his helmet hanging off the other side, and talking up a storm already. And so, you know, Doug pauses and Craig comes up, and you know, and Doug could just tell Tony has got to meet this guy, you know, because Craig was carrying his skis. That he was going up high to the upper reaches of Slaughter Gulch, above Slaughter Gulch, and going to go for the summer snow. And so they had a nice conversation, and next day Doug came over to the office, and Doug and I worked together, and said, "Hey, got to meet this guy." Well, Craig was working at Sackett's at the time, the restaurant there, and so first chance I got, I went up there and brought a little gift for him. I printed out an 8x10 photo of some mountains that I wanted to go ski. And he's down in the dish pit, and say, "Hey, I'm Tony," you know, and I, you know, shake his hand and pinned the photo to the wall so that he wouldn't have it down there in the dish pit, keep the photo nice and nice and clean. But sure enough, he was game for anything. And we made plans to go up to the Hunter's Trail right out of Turn Lake, which would give us access to the top of Mills Creek, mm-hmm. which is about 3,000 foot level. So I think a week later, we went up there for an overnighter and went and skied a peak, and been going for it ever since.
Nice.
Tony was really my angel there. I had been, you know, without a vehicle and skiing Cooper Landing, like it was my Chamonix. And I was just, and I still am so passionate about those mountains there. But Tony had a truck, and he had a list of mountains that he wanted to climb. And I was just like, "Point me at them. You're talking my language." And Tony said, "Oh, Chunk, you've corrupted me. Now I can't just ski the easiest ways down." And so Tony was still dropping the knee and doing the telly turns, but quickly he stood up and started skiing more efficiently. And so Tony's friends definitely noticed what a level he got to. And the rest is history. Tony and I have been friends for so long. He was a little disappointed that I moved down to Soldovia, so we don't get to see each other. So when we do, we really go after it big.
What have been some of your favorite trips?
Oh my gosh, there's numerous. And tomorrow you'll see a couple, but one of my favorite trips that's very accessible for all, you know, all levels of skiers is called Lazy Mountain, which is accessed via Jackaloff Bay by water taxi, or hopefully you got a friend with a boat, you know. Right there is Lazy Mountain, and one of the slideshows I'm going to do tomorrow night will show that trip that I did with Craig in 2015, and you know, one of those perfect days. We've got the whole playground basically to ourselves, of all these beautiful peaks, and the snow conditions are optimum, so that's one of them is Lazy Mountain. We'll talk more about that tomorrow night. It's a good one.
Okay, Craig, how about you?
Well, just last year, we went in to celebrate Tony's 60th birthday, and he had, like, let's just say 5 millionaires that were going to go into the Ruth Amphitheater in Talkeetna. And since now I'm, like, traveling around all these world-class climbing destinations, I have been in Alaska so long, and it's just about time I get to be where everyone from the world comes and skis. And we had one day in Talkeetna where it was snowing, and so we couldn't quite fly in there. We worked on our crevasse rescue skills and stuff. And we flew in the next day, and they had to pack, with the ski planes, they had to pack the runway down so they could take off again. And we had 7 blue sky days of 3-foot fresh powder that was super stable. And I showed up at Tony's house saying, I hope you have some work after I'm done this trip, because I don't have any money. You're going to have to sponsor the whole trip. And so he knew that I'd be good for the entertainment for all these other millionaires from Seattle and wherever. And sure enough, I was like, the mountain was calling me, you know, all around. I'm like, I'm going to go ski that. I don't care what you guys say. And so eventually they were like, Chunk, that's under a huge cornice. I'm like, I don't care. You know? And so we ended up skiing. I would say that we skied 7 days and just had such great quality ski touring. And that spot's not that known for it. So we walked into this, you know, skied into this famous spot. And when we left, we ended up skiing off Brill that day, and we saw the clouds in Talkeetna. And so we called up on our sat phone saying, hey, we don't want to get stuck in here. Come pick us up. And so that night they came, picked us up, and there was tracks all over the place.
Skiing has evolved over the years. I mean, gear obviously is always evolving, and techniques, like Tony, you know, you're saying you used to go down, you know, one knee at a time, and that has evolved and changed as well. What are some of the biggest changes for you guys in your skiing style or in the gear that you like to carry, anything like that?
Honestly, I was telling someone yesterday that this sport has been around so long. Now, is this from the Vikings that this started? And things haven't changed that much. It's still skis. It's still like some boots on some binding on your skis. And so you can almost, you know, tap into your ancestors that were doing the same sport. You know, and it evolved all over, you know, in Alaska, it had some roots, you know, in Vermont, telmarking kind of popped up simultaneously, like in Colorado, it popped up. So Tony and I were probably skiing leather boots a lot longer than people were. They started skiing plastic. And, you know, I had this saying, you know, ski with grace, leather and lace. But if you want to ski spastic, go for the plastic. And back then, you know, telmarking was the way in the backcountry. There wasn't split boards. There wasn't the AT skiing. Maybe we are hearing about that from Europe, the randonnée that was people were doing in. But in North America, telmarking was the way to get in the backcountry. And so, you know, Tony and I both started out on leather boots and skinny skis, skinny long skis. You know, when I hitchhiked to Alaska living in snow caves and clipping tickets, it was great because I could just, you know, wear my leather boots
out to the restaurant
all winter long.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, you know, things have changed, and it's been really awesome, especially when you help get other skiers on board, that they can ski so fast, and you kind of are like, it's not fair. You're this good, this quick. Yeah. And so we ski, you know, plastic boots now, but kind of grudgingly, you know, because I don't do the telmark turn anymore. And, you know, people just ask you, why don't you just stick, you know, go over to AT skiing. And, I dabble in that a little bit. But mostly I just like that little feeling of your heel coming up. And that if you fall, you can get back up and your skis are still on you and you can keep skiing away. And so.
What are you skiing on these days, Tony?
Well, about 5 years ago, I went to the new telemark norm.
Ooh.
And I actually still telemark, bend my knee. It has to be the right slope, the right snow, because it does take more effort. But when it's right for telemarking, that's the beauty of skiing on freehill equipment. What's neat about the new telemark norm is that I've basically done away with the duck bill, the 75 millimeter duck bill, got that out of the way. So the boot is a more compact boot. So if we're needing to do some climbing in the boot, it's easier to climb in, easier to walk in. What's also nice about the new interface is that, and I'll have these boots, my NTN boots at the talk tomorrow night so I can show folks, but it's just it's a more bomber connection to the ski. So you've got more control over your ski. And coming here, hopefully next year, Scarpa, who makes, in my opinion, the best NTN boot on the market, rumor has that they're going to be coming out with a carbon fiber boot.
Oh.
Because right now the AT, Alpine Touring setup, where you lock your heel down when you come down, are super lightweight boots compared to what I'm skiing on. So that's kind of a bit of a bummer. Though having said that, my NTN boots, the Scarpa TX Pro, is got a bellows in it. So if I want to telemark ski, I can easily do that with the bellows in the toe area. And it's got a nice stout cuff. So pretty much any terrain that I want to ski within reason, you know, any steep terrain, that sort of thing, I can do that with my setup. And then I get down to the flat terrain and I need to maneuver myself. I don't have to unlock my heel, lock my heel, unlock my heel, lock my heel. I'm free heel. So that's why I'm a firm believer in free heel skiing.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of that technology, as it advances, it kind of almost pigeonholes you a little more. I mean, it gets really good at like one specific thing that's great in a couple of specific scenarios. But sometimes you got to take a step back from the cutting edge if you still want to have that versatility sometimes.
Yeah, it's a small tribe. I mean, if you look at the global ski market, or, you know, most people are resort skiers. That's pretty big. And then, you know, you've got the backcountry skiers, the AT skiers. But there's a good, pretty good core group of freehill skiers out there that Scarpa, a big company, would be willing to spend the money to develop a brand new boot for our market. So I'm pretty passionate about the sport. Would love to, you know, see them continuing to innovate. Someday, maybe they'll have like skins, which we put on our skis so that we can climb up. The problem is right now is that those skins, when you remove them, sometimes will leave a residue of glue on the bottom of your ski. And of course, you want your ski to be really slick for the downhill run. So I'm hoping here soon they'll have a button you can press and change the characteristic of the bottom of the ski from sticky to, and I mean, I've heard rumors, you know, of this coming down the pike where you just like hit a button and, you know, boom, I'm slick, I'm sticky, you know. So it's all good. You know, technology's got some cool stuff coming down the line.
Definitely.
We've taken a little bit from the snowboarders, and they kind of blessed us with wider skis. We've taken a little bit from the ATers in this free pivot. Now we would never even wear a cable around our ankle on the way up. When we put those on or we give our hand-me-downs to some beginner, we're like, oh, at least they don't know the difference. So it's been neat. We're all working together to have just this great fun in the mountains.
Yeah. I, you know, we go out and I ski with AT skiers, no problem. They're fun to be with. So we love each other.
Rumble in the mountains. Yeah. It's a gear fight. You are tuned to KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. If you are joining us this hour, this is Adventure Talks on the Kenai Conversation. And we've got a program coming up tomorrow night at 6:30 p.m. at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. It's going to be Backyard Backcountry 2, talking about backcountry skiing with Tony Doyle. If you caught his presentation last year, I want to say, what was that last year?
Yeah, it was 2 years ago.
2 years ago, the recent past, anyway. Mm-hmm. He's bringing his friend Craig this time, and we're going to talk about skiing on the Southern Peninsula. Well, I am not talking about a dang thing. I've never skied on the Southern Kenai Peninsula, so. This is why we are bringing in the experts. Talking about gear a little bit and your guys' evolution with techniques and styles and new equipment. I always like to hit on safety in these things too, and I'm sure wisdom and knowledge and experience has evolved your guys' thinking on how to not get yourselves too banged up out there. And editor's note, of course, in radio, you can't see this, but Craig is in a boot. Not from skiing, but Craig is in a boot. So they know from what they speak in terms of accidents and avoiding them. What have you guys learned? Do you carry different things now? Do you approach things differently now? Did you learn some different safety backcountry techniques along the way?
Well, certainly. The early on, when I first started in the backcountry skiing, it was like a piece of orange cord that's 40 foot long. Okay, so if you get buried in a slide, we've got a piece of cord floating to the surface.
That blows my mind when people tell me about that. Like, that was literally the best we had.
Yeah, that was back in the early 80s. And avalanche beacons certainly were already probably available, but I didn't know about them. But pretty quickly, you know, the avalanche beacon came onto the scene, and at first it was, you know, pretty squelchy and not very user-friendly. And of course, over the last 20 plus years, they've really evolved into pretty easy to use, friendly thing. But for me, it was obvious that a good shovel, a compact shovel, would be very handy to have. So, you know, I got one of those for my pack early on, and studying like out of the Freedom of the Hills, taking a mountaineering course for me early on was very helpful for me to kind of understand mountains and the sunny side, the lee side, the windward side, cornices and crevasses and that sort of thing. So just even reading a book like The Freedom of the Hills and familiarizing myself with those dangers, those objective dangers out there. A lot of stuff is just, hey, you're out there having fun and you want to forecast and you want to be prepared best you can, but the reality of it is, it's why it is an adventure. You're going to go out there and put yourself in harm's way occasionally, and so you definitely want to pad your chances with having a good probe, so if somebody does get buried, you can poke down the snow and find them, and hopefully they've got their beacon turned on. And so all those things are you know, kind of something that good to talk about for myself, because like the last avalanche workshop I took was probably 20 years ago. So I'm way overdue to go do a workshop and refresh my skills. That certainly in 20 years, the techniques and the knowledge has advanced big time in that area. So it's a continual learning process.
And we've got much better forecasting. That industry alone has come a long way, but access to good forecasts as well with the magic of the internets and whatnot.
Exactly, yeah.
And weather forecasting has definitely improved. So what's your safety strategy if you're going out? Do you check forecasts? Do you dig through the snow? Do you test along the way? What are you doing?
Well, I ski at Summit Lake quite a bit, okay? So I'm kind of a little bit maybe complacent sometimes. I go up there and ski my same runs and, you know, but if I'm going to go to a new spot, I will go onto the Chugach National Forest, get the link to the avalanche forecasting portion of that website and read their reports. Certainly check temperatures and that sort of thing. But, you know, beyond that, Craig, what's your kind of your protocol?
Oh, I love this question. People always ask me, oh, we need a good avalanche instructor. And I'm like, hello. I've been in three. I've learned my lessons. And so every avalanche I've ever been in has been in red light conditions. And so one of the simple things you ask yourself when you're out there is like, hello, is this green light? And you start to learn just from a basic avalanche 101 class, you know, that like, is it trending toward worse or is it trending toward better? You know, that kind of question. Have we seen a lot of snow? Is there tons of sun right now? Wind, you know, those questions.
And by red light, so you're not just talking about today's pinpoint conditions. I mean, you also need to be aware of what's been happening in the mountains, because whatever this new layer of snow, what layer is that sitting on? Might that be icy? Is that going to be stable? I mean, it's more than just that day, that moment, being aware of what's going on.
so true. You know, you go out and maybe you don't do your best run right in the beginning. Maybe you ski a little other run that's more safe. And then you feel the snow out and see what it does that time. When you ski up, you can dig these little hand pit tests that don't take a lot of time, and you pack them the same way, and you can tell right away if it like is failing or if it's passing, and you can feel how stuck the snow is onto that surface. So I always like, I'll quickly tell my stories because I think they're very educational. And I have pictures for one of them, but the first one, I got up on top of a mountain that I had to climb up on, and I was poking my pole in the snow, and it was on solstice, so June 22nd, and it was over across Ketchumak Bay, and the snow was just totally rotten, but I was trapped on that mountain, and I thought, oh, it'll be fine. You're always nervous, and it wasn't fine. And I'll go off more on that story. It's a pretty fun one. And then the second one, I was up above Girdwood, and my buddy and I had skied up there. And the first day it was 6 inches of snow. Second day it was 2 feet of snow. The next day it was 4 feet of snow. We were skiing over our heads powder that day. Then it snowed another 4 feet that night. And we're like, oh, I bet the car's stuck. We got to get out of here. And so we just left in a whiteout that day. And we just got walloped on the way down. And I thought my buddy was still on top of the mountain. And he was right next to me with just his head up out of the snow. So I went and helped him out. And of course, we had to walk into Girdwood. And they told us in the bar that, oh, you guys are very stupid, but we've been stupid too, so we'll buy you this beer. And of course, we had to sleep in the post office that night. And so then another, I was up behind my mountains in Soldovia one night, and I knew it was very risky. I heard the woofing, and it had been woofing for a week, and it woofed like 20 times as I went up to go kite. I like kiting. It pulls me up the mountains. Well, the skiers like to complain. They always say, oh, if we only had a lift here. And I'm like, well, I got that problem taken care of. Oh, this beautiful snow comes, and then the wind comes and messes it all up. Well, I got that problem taken care of. And so I was up there. I was just kiting and into the sunset because I knew I could just ski down in a half an hour to the car. And as I was, you know, I put the kite away and I started skiing down, and I go, oh, no. This is no trespassing. I'm not supposed to be on this side of the mountain right now. In fact, it should just, and sure enough, I watched it. Wham! Crown, my mountain crown, the neighboring mountain crown, that famous grinding sound of an avalanche rumbling down the hills. And luckily, I was right on top of it. And I was like, do I ditch my skis? Do I throw my poles? And I was like, I'd get up and ski and then fall and then ski and fall, like riding the magic carpet down. And then I got off the bottom and I was like, that's not that bad. I didn't lose my gear. I'm not spitting blood. And I just could ski right back to the car. So I think those are some good examples. You know, the first one was like, I was totally young and naive. And the second one, I still hope that if that happened again, I wouldn't panic and I would stay, even though we ran out of food in that cabin, and wait, because an hour later, the sun came out, all the avalanche debris that we had crossed, it had all slid. And so if we had just waited in that cabin, even though it was like panic time, that it snowed another 4 feet, that I'm hoping that I would have done that today. And then that last one, they always talk about complacency, and it got me, and I quickly realized it was getting me.
I recently had the good fortune of a good buddy of mine is an avalanche forecaster for Chugach Electric, and he's invited me out. Last couple times he's gone out to climb at Summit Lake above the power lines there to the upper bowls on, I think, Colorado Mountain, actually, or Summit Mountain. But it's very interesting to actually go out with the professional forecaster and watch him dig his pits, you know, take the lens out, the snow crystals, looking at the snow crystals, his log book. And you know, so I was learning a thing or two from Paul Wanneke, is my buddy, and I'm going, yeah, I I think I might have to get my snow pit digging skills buffed up here as I continue, you know, to go into the big mountains. Inevitably, you're going to find yourself skiing avalanche terrain, which is about 35 to 40 degree slopes, 30 to 40 degree slopes. Those are the most exciting slopes to ski. And best be prepared and best not be complacent.
Right. Good continual reminders to have for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely messes up your ski season if you wind up getting yourself hurt. And I should clarify, Craig, your boot was not from a skiing incident. You were off climbing. Side story, but where were you?
Oh, you know, there's a perfect time for me to leave Alaska. And there's not many times that I want to leave. But right there in November, it's like you kind of get your dividend and then you can take a little break to keep your sanity. And so I'm realizing how quickly life goes and how fast it's going. And I better get on with my big dreams, you know. And so I have had this dream of climbing the top 10 climbing destinations of the world. And so I went to Mexico as a little warm-up trip. And then I went up to Greece last year. And when I go to these spots, I'm like, with climbers from all over the world, and it is perfectly heaven. You just can't even, you're climbing right next to people and you're grunting your way up the cliff and you can take a picture of them, even though they're strangers, because you get such a great picture. And you go to the ground and you get their internet address, and then, you know, you just send it to them and they're just so thankful that you just got, you know, of their dream vacation too. So this last year, I was pretty nervous because I went to learn paragliding down in Utah, and I survived that part of it, and I thought I was home free climbing in Spain. And there's always lessons in all these stories. And so, yeah, I was in Spanish paradise for a week, and I was just settling into this and had a great bunch of friends. And I took a long leader fall. Something that I still don't understand quite how I did hurt myself, but I did end up in a Spanish hospital for 2 weeks. And of course, I don't speak Spanish. And the only thing that I understood was when they were saying, it is very bad.
Gosh. Yeah, not the medical report you're hoping for when the doctor walks in the room in a foreign hospital.
Yeah.
So tomorrow night, you guys are covering across Ketchumak Bay. Are you getting up Fox River or anything like that? Or what sort of area are you planning on telling us about?
Well, I think it's going to kind of break up pretty nicely for our talk. I think Craig is going to be talking about some of his trips kind of on the northern part of the ice cap, the Gruinck Glacier area. And I'll be doing a presentation about traversing from the Woznesinski Glacier over to the Outer Coast Nootka Passage. And then we'll be doing a joint trip. And Craig was on that trip, that traverse. I was not on the trips that Craig's going to be talking about. Is that right, Craig? The two trips you're going to be sharing. And so it's going to it's going to go from the northern portion of the Ketchumak Glacial Complex, if I could say that.
Three times fast, please.
Ketchumak Glacial Complex. it's amazing over there. It's just it's amazing. It's a maze of glaciers. And so then I think the final slideshow that I'm going to do is going to be just a trip that Craig and I did together down close to Soldovia.
Nice. How do those mountains compare to what skiers in this area might be familiar with? I mean, just in my limited experience over there, hiking the new Tutka Backdoor Trail and other things over there, they're a lot more jagged than I have in my mind until I'm out there.
Honestly, you know, up at Summit and Turnagain, they have great, awesome powder. And we get a lot of wind, and our storms don't dump nearly as much snow as... But in the springtime, there's this magic. If you can hold off and have the endurance, I love bragging when I'm out in the world that I have just so many unclimbed peaks out there. And that's pretty much unheard of in this world, that people are to have just peaks with no names on them that you can go and get is my passion. So I'm telling a little secret.
Well, and you have a bit of a leg up on most skiers around here in that you live in Seldovia, so you're already not much closer to access, but there's water in between, so that's a little bit of a hurdle. And then there's the local knowledge thing. How do you even get to where you start getting up the mountains? There's an awful lot of bushwhacky nonsense over there. There's water landings and boats you got to finagle. So if people wanted to go start exploring over there, do you have any recommendations for just like even access points to get up to where they might find some good snow?
Since I'm a local in Seldovia, I've been shunned to silence on that subject.
Oh, yeah, don't tell people to go across private property or anything. I'm gonna
kind of start by saying that the mountains that have called me are even though there could be some trouble, that is part of the fun. Maybe it's class two fun where it's fun afterwards. And so all you have to do is stand in Homer like I want to do when I'm in the retirement home and say, I've climbed all those peaks. And they're going to say, no, you're crazy. And then someone like Tony is going to back me up and say, no, he has climbed them all. And of course, that's why we take pictures, because we know our memories like that. But I would just start saying, plan it out. Now, Tony can talk more about the access because he's not...
I'm safe. I live up here in Kenai, so I'm not going to...
Yeah, you're not going to tick off the neighbors if you're giving away state secrets here.
Alaska's a vast land, and Kachemak Bay, the beautiful part of Kachemak Bay, skiing across Kachemak Bay, is that you're on glaciers. Where at Summit Lake, you're not on glaciers. Turnagain Pass, you're not on glaciers, you know, but across Kachemak Bay, you're on glaciers, and they're old glaciers. And when we go skiing on those glaciers, it's typically late spring, early summer. So moving around with the crevasses is pretty easy to get around them and see them. And so we don't ski over there roped up very much because everything's pretty well exposed, but it's amazing. Yeah. I mean, to go over there and stand on those peaks and then look out, there's more peaks. It's like, I've not even seen those peaks. And here I am looking at those peaks. So as far as getting over there, water taxi is a great way to go. Hopefully you have a friend with a boat.
We're going to have some great access. Like you said, the Tucker Backdoor Trail. I've been lucky enough to volunteer on that trail too.
Yeah. You've been one of the builders on that thing.
And work with some of my idols, Hig and Aaron. And so we went up there one winter and I was able to like ski off like four new peaks for me. So that was just a highlight of that winter. We're really excited about the Bradley Lake, and they just cut a new trail, you know, to divert that river into the lake. So that's going to be just amazing access. See how that's so far away from Seldovia. I can talk about that one. For me, I loved Alaska because I could ski year round. And back in the day, I did do a trip from Seward to Homer on the ice field. And so I didn't really want to move away from Cooper Landing. It's still like so dear in my heart. But moving closer to the ice fields is makes me feel very happy that I'm right there, right where I want to be. And this journey,
you know, I think tomorrow night we'll talk a little bit more about actual access. I've mentioned the mountain, Lazy Mountain, and that's a very popular ski mountain for folks from Homer that traditionally go over there in the springtime. And the trail is not necessarily a maintained trail, but it's a well-used local trail. It's got flagging on it, and it's pretty easy to find the trail. And so, you know, I'm all about helping people get up on Lazy Mountain. I mean, what a wonderful place. You get up there and it's pretty low angle when you get up on it. So there's really great touring for all skill level. And if you want to, you know, go big or ski something more challenging, then you can. So it's really just an awesome trip. And we'll talk more about that tomorrow.
Kind of the Manitoba of Kachemak Bay. Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Nice. Yeah. Are there many opportunities like that over there that are day trip skis? Nice thing about the Summit area, you drive up, hike up, ski down back in your car somewhere for a burger later that night. But it sounds like a lot of the stuff you're doing is multi-day.
One of the spots I love skiing in the spring is Sadie Peak. And as you're coming over the hill and dropping into Homer, that's the big one that you're looking at. Mm-hmm. And it, the face that we ski is kind of a south-facing one. And we pull our boat right up there and anchor it. And as we go up early in the morning to be safe, there's all this avalanche debris that's like beach balls and bowling balls that are as hard as a rock in the morning. And it comes right to the ocean. And so we go up that with the crampons on, and we get to the top of Sadie and we ski off of it. But by the afternoon, that all those beach balls are all mush, so you can ski just amazing right back to the ocean. So once a year, that's a classic to go ski that.
I think the peak right out of your backyard, Craig, called Graduation Peak, and named Graduation Peak because the kids that graduate in Soldovia, they go out there and party, you know, after graduation. But that one is like right out of Craig's back door. And it's amazing access up a power line, as I recall, right? So there's a little bit of booting and climbing that you got to do. But once you get up through that first 500 foot of elevation gain, then you're on beautiful, easy terrain for a long way. So that's right close to home, right?
Tony and I got this little thing we have going now is we'll go up and ditch our overnight backpacks right at Tundra there. And the sun's on us, and we watch the sunset. And then right then in the morning, the sun will hit us again at dawn. And so we're in the sun again, and so for our coffee. And then we leave all our gear, and then we're nice and light, and we go up and play in the mountains there.
You guys make it sound like it's all sunshine and rainbows and coffee in the nice late morning sun. But especially as you get to the outer coast, you have some potential for some pretty nasty weather out there.
You know, it's amazing. Been going through my different trips in preparation for the presentation tomorrow night. And it's like, wow, there's a lot of blue sky days. But believe me, I have my Gore-Tex pants, my Gore-Tex shell, my layers, and they get used because you're right. There's been times when we have been hammered pretty bad, and it can be downright miserable even with all the good gear.
We're really lucky to have great weather forecast now. They even tell you how much wind is going to be out there. So if you're lucky enough to have no work schedule and not be on the Weekend Warrior program, then you can see these blue sky days coming miles away.
Take advantage of it when you can.
Yep.
So we're getting up to the top of the hour, but what's on your bucket list? What's the next big thing you guys want to get out and do?
You know, I think for me, I'm actually starting to do more skiing over towards Seward, which has really big mountains. Mm-hmm. And got a good friend over there in Seward that's an avid skier. And so I'm actually looking forward to skiing on Andy Simons, which is a big peak right as you pass Kenai Lake on the left going towards Seward. And, you know, I just designed a house for a gentleman that lives in Moose Pass, and so
he's staring at that out the window.
Well, yeah, exactly. So he lives part of the time outside and part of the time here, so I'll be his caretaker of his house. And you know, and I'm thinking Seward area has kind of really got me interested big time.
Craig, what about you?
Well, I love coming up to Tony's house. He's got this big map, and he's got pins in it. And he's got, like, color-coded pins. These are the mountains that are over 5,000 feet. These are the mountains I've gotten. These are the mountains I want to get. And so as my skiing is kind of plateaued off, or maybe I'm not even as good as I used to be, but as my ice climbing and as my climbing gets better, I feel like, wow, this is a really neat place to be where I can still get to the tops of these peaks, know when I need a rope or when I need, you know, when I need to down climb and I can't ski them. And so luckily my brain keeps growing. And so that's my goal is Tony and I always like going and summoning new peaks together. And so I would say that's in the future when I can walk again.
Yeah.
Good to have goals. Well, it is coming up on the top of the hour, so we need to sign off, but you can hear more from these guys tomorrow night at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center, 6:30 p.m. Free, of course, for KDLL members, $5 for non-members. We hope to see you guys there. Craig and Tony, thank you so much for being on the air with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jenny.
All right. This is, of course, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, KenaiSoul.net.